Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is David Cole from Lynn Pinker in Dallas. David is an appellate lawyer who has done many different things, and you may have seen him on media appearances. He's got some appellate blogs, and we'll kind of talk about all that stuff. But David, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, and I look forward to returning the favor and having you guys in a week or two.
Absolutely. And we'll talk about your podcast a little bit later on, too. For any of our listeners who may not know you, just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and that kind of stuff.
Well, I'm a sixth-generation Texan. I was born in Dallas at Presbyterian Hospital when it was kind of out in the country. Grew up in Allen in the suburbs up there when it was still largely country. We had just turned 4A. Went out of state to college, came back to law school at UT, and clerked in Dallas and have practiced law in Dallas ever since. So I'm a Dallas guy from way back. In our city, that's relatively uncommon. Most people seem to have moved there from somewhere over the last 20-odd years, but I've been around a while here.
So you clerked for Judge Higginbotham of the Fifth Circuit, right?
Correct. Yes.
I mean, how was that experience?
He was really in the top of his game. He's been active since then, even though he's taken senior status. He was had recently been on the short list for a Supreme Court nomination in the Reagan administration. That had kind of come and gone, but he was still very prominent in judicial circles, and he was very active in a lot of activities. He flew to Washington to testify a couple of times. It was exciting. And it was really exciting to get to go to New Orleans. I mean, I've never been before. And all of a sudden you get off the plane and there's this ginormous courthouse in the middle of Sin City. It's the most biggest contrast you can imagine. And so that was just a wonderful experience above and beyond the ordinary things about being in a clerkship.
Yeah, I always thought that would be a really great aspect of being a Fifth Circuit clerk is getting to being in your local spot with your judge and in their locale, but being able to go to New Orleans periodically for oral argument.
It's just when the Fifth Circuit's in session, you can go station yourself somewhere on Bourbon Street, the place I leave to your sound discretion, but you can just sit there and watch, you know, all these people carrying on having parties, and you'll see some of the most conservative federal judges in America walking down the street to their hotel. You know, there'll be guest street hustlers and people banging on drums and partiers with drinks in their hands and Edith Jones walking on by with her law clerks. It's just it's the most fascinating contrast, but it enriches both. The court benefits by being part of the unusual culture of New Orleans, and you know, they're very proud of it there. And it's something everybody really looks forward to.
And you were there at a time when kind of some of the very legendary Fifth Circuit judges were still on the bench or maybe even in senior status, you know, the Judge Wisdoms, the Judge Browns, like that.
Well, yeah, Judge Brown had passed away, but we did sit with Judge Wisdom a couple of times, once in particular. And I remember vividly, I forget who the third judge was on the panel, but the arguments had concluded for the day. And so the judges were getting up to go back to their conference, and the parties were still hanging around from the last argument, packing up their stuff. And Judge Wisdom, in his big booming voice, and he says in sort of loud voice to the clerk that was sitting there, "Tell my law clerk," his big Southern accent. And so everybody in the room is like, the old man is going to give it up, right? He's going to say how he's going to vote in this case. He's going to blow it right here in front of everybody. Everybody's doing E.F. Hutton and listening to what he has to say. And even the other two judges are turning around like, what the hell is Wisdom doing? And then the booming voice continues, "To get my salmon sandwich from the refrigerator and place it on the table." And he walks out of the room. It's like, you just trolled the whole room. You did that on purpose.
And making it sound so elegant.
I know. It's like, oh, salmon sandwich. Get that man sandwich. Don't keep him waiting. He was a showman. He had a sense of theater. A few other moments like that when we sat with him. But I thought, you did that. You could have waited to get your sandwich, but you had to do it right there in front of everybody. That was impressed. Style points.
Absolutely. So how did you kind of get to what you're doing today after you got done with your clerkship? What was your career path?
I had a practice as a general business litigator for a number of years, had tried cases and took depositions and all that stuff. Still do a little bit of that on some clients I've had for a long time. But I joined this firm, Lynn Pinker, about 11 years ago, and very quickly evolved to the kind of practice I have now. They didn't really have an appellate specialist. I was sort of interested in trying to develop that practice. And very quickly, it sort of evolved to where I became the appellate lawyer at a firm of trial lawyers at a trial boutique. And we've grown over time, and my responsibilities have kind of evolved with that. But I'm still the appeal guy, or 30, 40 lawyers, depending on, you know, the vagaries of the season. And I'm the law guy in the face of people that really like going down to the courthouse and trying cases. So it is the pandemic sort of slowed things down a little bit, but it is a daily roller coaster ride around here. There's a lot of adventure in this office, which I think is fantastic. It's very, very stimulating, very enriching.
Have they offered you, I guess you have associates in the office that you have at your disposal. Do you have anybody dedicated to you and your practice specifically? Or are you?
Not really. Over time, people have been more or less interested in appellate work, and I've had people that have spent more of their out time with me. But generally speaking, people come here because they want to go to trial. And they really want to take depositions. They want to go to court. And they're certainly happy to help with appeals, but that's not why they get out of bed in the morning, is to work on appellate stuff. So I have to be creative and resourceful in getting the staff that you need for a brief. And, you know, some days that's more of a challenge than others. I think it's great that you have a lot of associates that want to go to court and kick butt and take names, but I have to kind of acknowledge reality that people want to be trial lawyers, even if from a young age here. And I've just got to deal with that in getting things staffed up the way I'd like to. If you like bureaucracy, this is not the place to be. This is not how we roll here at this office.
How much of your practice is sort of the trial side of appellate stuff, you know, the legal issues, the talking to judges, the charge stuff versus actually briefing in courts of appeals?
Good question. It's about half and half on average. Of course, it's never an average day.
Sure.
But generally speaking, I would say about half the practice in a given week, given day, is sort of traditional thinking, great thoughts and writing briefs type of practice. And the other half is what I would call the either trial practice and sense of motion practice there, or the drop-in traffic, which is my 30, 40 aggressive partners. I want to go, things come up and they come by, you know, the questions, you hear them all the time too. Number one, can we appeal that? Number two, can we mandamus that? You know, number three, you know, a good bail bondsman, you know, that kind of thing. During the pandemic, I missed that because people would call up and email, but it's one thing to do that. Another thing, just be sitting in your office and have people drop by.
Sure.
And it's I can give very quick answers sometimes. Other times it turns out there's really something going on and I need to get in, draft something or something like that. But I think that's a benefit of our kind of lack of structures, that people can kind of come and go like that. And I can be a part of a lot of different cases without having to stick my nose in and peer and, you know, have more of me than they want. All you want is a 15 minute consult. That's good. By the way, the question I used to get a lot, which you guys I know got in your practice, was in addition to can we appeal that, is does the TCPA apply to that?
Yeah.
That was like a full-time practice there.
For 100%. And the answer was almost always yes.
Yeah. Nobody, I missed my TCPA notes because I haven't had to look at them for a couple of years now. It's kind of died out. Probably for the good, I guess.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. So how are things now? I mean, I think we all have probably seen in the last couple of years, everything sort of went quiet on the trial side. Mm-hmm. For a trial firm, how is business? Are things coming back with a vengeance? I know it feels like that for me, that I've seen so many things get set in the last 6 to 8 months, you know, that hadn't been set for 2 years.
Yeah, it's definitely what I noticed over the last couple of years, really more in the first year of the pandemic, was, you know, after an initial shock where nothing happened, as everybody was home, then things began to come back online. And as an appellate lawyer, My overall workload sort of returned to the normal level, but the composition changed. Judges are still going to the office. They've still got law clerks. So they were just doing other things besides trying cases. So motions that might have sat around for a while to get decided now are getting decided like that after the hearing. And so the velocity of motion practice picked way up. And that was a lot of things that otherwise would just sort of lingered were not lingering. And then people got more used to Zoom and were able to conduct trials and whatnot and hearings. And that got the trial guys back in business again. We've had jury trials and bench trials scheduled now without really much in the way of COVID protocols required. That's good. Everyone seems comfortable with that now. And you're right. The backlog is enormous. I'm not sure what we're going to do about all that, particularly in federal court, where a lot of criminal cases by law have priority. Mm-hmm. The trial act. And I don't, that's going to be a real challenge that we're going to have to deal with the next couple of years. And I don't know what there is to do except just get to it and start trying cases.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think that that's it's had an impact on what comes out of the Court of Appeals. If you look at opinions, there's a lot. The last couple of years have been a lot more motion-y type things, a lot of summary judgment rulings, a lot of forum type things. That's just what there's been. There haven't been trials to review. My jury charge folder here is kind of sad and lonesome, but dust it off and do some stuff with it one of these days.
Yeah, that raises the point. You mentioned the federal courts, and of course, in their metropolitan areas like we're in, we are fortunate that we tend to have a division between civil and criminal courts. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we'll have quite as much trouble in state courts and those types of jurisdictions, but it's still a problem. We still have giant backlogs from the pandemic. So I think the consensus, maybe it's consensus, maybe it's not, is that we certainly trial lawyers and then, you know, the appellate lawyers who go to trial lawyers like the three of us are going to be busy for quite some time to come.
Well, I'm certainly have high hopes for that. I think that, you know, there are a couple other pressures I think we're going to experience. There's certainly going to be some pressure to settle cases because who wants to wait a long time to have trial? The flip of that, of course, is nothing induces settlement quite like a trial date, a credible trial date. Being 42nd on the docket doesn't do very much. Being fifth or sixth, that gets some. So I think judges may become more assertive about on that set of cases that's in the strike zone, ordering mediations or something to try and move a few extra cases along. Mm-hmm. And I also, this is a reason why appellate work might increase. So it's obviously a good thing, but it might not be good for society if people start rushing and maybe don't take the time to get everything lined up like they might want to because they're just so excited to get a bunch of stuff in the pipeline. I'm not sure how that might play out, but it's just something to be mindful of. We have unusual pressures on people's dockets right now, both courts and litigants, that we've just not ever seen. We've never had 2 years where people just didn't do anything by way of trial. And that's going to, I'm not quite sure how that's going to cut, but it can't have that many cases built up and not have it influence behavior somehow. And either, you know, more reliance on forms or more pressure to just get stuff out there or settle or something. We're going to be seeing that bubble up into the work we do.
I think that's exactly right. How much of your practice is federal versus state, or does it just sort of vary? I know you keep up with both a lot.
There, it'll be, honestly, it'll be like 100% of one or 100% of the other. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of really big things take up a lot of time and it swings back the other way. So on average, it's probably more state than federal over the course of a year. But at any given time, you know, a couple of big federal things are coming along and that's all consuming. So it's hard to generalize. You know, like, for example, this week we had a couple of cases set. One is settled. I don't know about the other. One was in state court in Dallas. The other is in federal court out in Texarkana. And that's just how it goes. You have a couple of things set in different jurisdictions. Next month, who knows? And of course, arbitrations are, appellate lawyers have no, there's no place for us in arbitration. Yeah. But for trial lawyers, that's very real. And it's something that factors into the mix too of where your partners are going and what they're doing. And of course, that isn't quite covered. The ABA, the AAA has got a lot of stuff on its docket, but its pressures are a little different than a courtroom. I think they were able to move things along, maybe a little better during the pandemic, but that's just speculation.
Yeah, we're a little bit like the appendix of an arbitration proceeding because we're there, we're sort of superfluous. But if something goes wrong, then, you know, occasionally we get involved.
We're useful if the arbitrator actually wants to follow the law.
That's true.
That's right. Yes. No, that's So, you know, arbitration, gotta love it. Is it really a more efficient, faster way of resolving cases? Well, it depends on the case.
I think everyone on this call probably has a similar perspective to you.
You never know how it's going to go.
It's a little hard to get super interested in arbitration as an appellate lawyer because they've, you know, the Fifth Circuit pretty much killed every challenge that there ever was.
Well, right. Yeah. No. So I've got this award. Can I challenge it? Huh? Maybe the TCPA applies.
probably not. Not anymore.
Yeah. No. I'm happy to talk to you, but no, I don't think it's going to work. Yeah. But yeah, yeah.
The good old manifest disregard.
Where is the love? R.I.P. Yes, where is the love?
Does your office have a fair amount of arbitration practice? Is that something y'all do quite a bit of?
Yes, it depends on the type of case, but you see it and you see a lot of sparring around about whether a case will be in arbitration or in beginning of your case. Sometimes that can be outcome determinative. You have that and the case resolves once you know where it's going to be. During the pandemic, I'm not going to suggest that anything was just rocking along. Everything was so affected. But we were able to conduct, in addition to a couple of bench trials by Zoom, we were able to do some arbitrations using COVID protocols and things. And it went fine. You're able to control things a little more in your office than you are when you have jurors coming in, have to be mindful how you run a public building. So I'm hopeful was the case around the country. And we were able to at least keep those cases moving along somewhat through the pipeline.
That makes a lot of sense. And I hadn't really thought about it. You know, to your point, I don't really get involved in arbitrations unless the question is this arbitrable? And then that's kind of the one place appellate lawyers actually get to weigh in and maybe have something to do. But, you know, other than that, people don't really need us for a whole lot of stuff there.
The only reason I knew a lot about that one arbitration was they were going to have it at a hotel somewhere. And because, of course, it was 2020 and everything had to fail. The air conditioning failed in the hotel. And so that wasn't going to work. It was August or something. So they came to our office. So the conference rooms down the hall all got shanghaied for this arbitration. Everybody's in there fanning themselves. And so they finished it out in our office. We did have air conditioning for the rest of the week. But I thought, that's bad. That's really bad. You know, the COVID box, and you end up in the global warming box. It's just it's a rough year.
That's exactly right.
It has been an interesting couple of years, that is for sure.
Well, one of the things that I think people probably know you for are your blogs, and I'm just going to call them the 600 blogs, 600 Camp, 600 Commerce, and 600 Hemp Hill, which are the Fifth Circuit, the Dallas Court of Appeals, and the Texas Supreme Court. How did you get into legal blogging?
The 600 Camp was the first. The year before I joined this firm, I was the chair of our State Bar Appellate Section, and at least during that year, it seemed that a lot of CLE programs liked to have the chair of the appellate section on their program. So was invited to speak for a number of more CLEs than I ordinarily did. And I, to try to get some common ground so I didn't have to write a whole bunch of papers, I sort of focused in on Fifth Circuit updates and issues that were relevant in the Fifth Circuit. So I got in the habit of that year, maybe the year before that, of reading daily, or at least interacting daily with the email the Fifth Circuit sends out that summarizes what cases they decided that day. Sometimes I think it's three per day. And I got in the habit of that and got to where I kind of process it pretty quickly and said, you know what, I can do a blog with this. I'm doing it on the reading anyway. I'm getting a lot out of this. This is something I should keep on doing. I could do a little summary of some things and have a blog. And it seemed that sort of fit in well with some things we were doing here when I joined with our website and internet presence. I just sort of started out simply with just the published cases, not unpublished cases, and went on from there. I was thinking about expanding it to our Intermediate Court of Appeals here in Dallas. And my colleague, Mike Lynn, I was thinking about names. He goes, isn't the state courthouse here have the same address as 600 Camp? Which in fact it does. I went, I'll be darned. You're exactly right, Mike. Thus was 600 Commerce born. Same format, same style. I didn't really do much on it the first couple of years we did it. One of my colleagues did it. Some other people did it. And then over time, a couple of them left and some other associates moved on to other kinds of practice. And I picked that up as well. And both have now obviously a similar voice. And so I do the content for both of them. The 600 Camp celebrated its 10th anniversary here a few months ago, which is a good long lifetime.
Wow, that is. Happy anniversary.
And the key to longevity there is better to be competent than brilliant. I try to say something useful every week or two, a few posts a week. They're short. None of them are masterpieces. But over time, during the course of a year, I hope that I have said a lot of little things that add up to wisdom. What kills you in blogging is trying to do a brilliant work every week or two. You just can't do it. No one's that smart. anyone who's a practicing lawyer has a lot of other demands on their time. You just aren't going to get it done. And so by sort of setting the target at be competent, but maintain it, I was able to keep it going for years and years. And it's easy. It fits right into my schedule now. I've gotten efficient at it. I know what I want to do. Other people may not like it. It may not be for them. Start your own blog. It's a free And so I get a lot of excitement, happiness out of it. I really enjoy it. I think it's fascinating to be engaged with all these cases coming out from these courts every week. And, you know, then I can very quickly leverage it into CLE programs on the courts or particular issues or anything of that nature that I may find interesting. So one foot in front of the other for 10 years. That's how it's worked.
You know, I agree with what you said about how to keep a blog going, because having ventured down that path myself, it is extremely difficult to do at a high level for any length of time. And so any blog that's been around for 10 years, gosh, I got to pay my respects.
Baby steps. Yeah, there are a couple of, I had a 10-year celebratory post here a few months ago, and there are a couple of running gags that I've had for that time. One is anybody who corrects a mistake, sends me an email, is on the list for valuable 600 camp merchandise. I don't have any merchandise. I've never had any merchandise. But if I ever have some, I have a long list. So send me a correction when you see something. And then there was several years ago, there was a case involving a seizure of a boat. It was a merchant vessel something. I forget the name of it. And the case was held to be moot on appeal because literally the ship had sailed. It had left New Orleans and the Fifth Circuit, and there was nothing anybody could do about it. So that was the ship has sailed mootness doctrine. And I thought that was fascinating. I had a little heading on the blog for about a year called Where is the Name of the Boat? And you can track these things. Their websites track freighters, and you can see where it was every day, nowhere near New Orleans. And I looked it up for the 10-year post. I wonder how my old friends are doing. And the boat is still floating. It's changed names a couple of times, but it was in Singapore or something. There are my old friends still sailing. Hasn't been to the United States in the last 10 years, I don't think, ever since it left New Orleans. But that's been kind of a funny encounter. Those people who own that boat are probably wondering why they get all these hits.
Yeah, really? Who's this one guy in Dallas that follows us so closely?
Because it's the Jolly Roger, is that thing is sailing around avoiding
it. Oh, that's great.
But who knew, right? But that's kind of the fun thing, sort of thing you run across when you read a lot of cases, little mini stories like that.
Well, and you're building out your own sort of research library right there. I mean, that's one of the great things I found is that I learned in blogging. One of the lessons I learned was, your work product, you kind of get a little personal library of research and things that have piqued your interest. So I can see how you could turn that into a CLE pretty easily.
Yeah, if someone says, do you know a case that says such and such? Well, an associate that goes to answer that question will get on Westlaw. I might, depending on the question, but I'm probably going to get on one of the blogs and I remember something and look it up and then go from there. I started 600 Hempel a few years ago to sort of keep the same format going with the state Supreme Court. I'm going to fold that into 600 Commerce this year. It just, the Supreme Court of the U.S. and Texas are just different than the intermediate courts and appeals. They don't really produce that many opinions. The opinions they do produce are much longer, have a lot more dissents and things. The real action in those courts is on what they decide to take and don't decide to take. And that's very hard to keep up with without doing a lot of reading. All I have to do for the other blogs, I just get an email every day that says, here's what we decided. Or in the case of the Dallas court, I go look and there it is, list of cases, 10 seconds. Right. But to do that extra work starts you down the road of having to do something of high quality every couple of weeks, which I know means blogging death. So what I'm going to take it and fold it into Commerce and have occasional reports about the state Supreme Court, particularly if they involve a Dallas case. But it's been fun, but it just isn't really the same thing as the other two blogs have been. And look at SCOTUS blog, Tom Goldstein's. I mean, they've got a whole set of conversations going there all the time. It's a fascinating place to go look and read about Supreme Court cases, but that's never going to happen for a blog about an intermediate court of appeals. There are just way too many cases spread way all over the place. You just aren't ever going to get that kind of sustained dialogue about even the highest profile case. So that's fine with me. I'll just do my thing and let somebody else cover those courts.
Sure. Well, and even if somebody takes one nugget here and one nugget there, at least it's something useful, for the reader and frankly for you and people that you work with, because you guys practice in Dallas.
A little touch here and a little touch there. And you have to, if you want to subscribe. That's great. If you just want to look in every month or so, it's there. It's not going anywhere. In fact, I'm going to try to upgrade the tech here this year. I've my poor WordPress off-the-shelf thing I'm using is obsolete. The guy doesn't update it anymore. I think I'm the only person still using this particular package. So it's time to, you know, make it look a little less 2011, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, it works. People can access it. Doesn't have to be fancy. That's another thing that'll kill you in blogging is trying to make something stunningly beautiful. Oh, people don't want that. They want to read. They don't want to be.
Right.
They're appellate lawyers. They just want to read words. They don't want to look at pretty pictures.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you look at the formatting of, you know, a Westlaw case that you print out, it's more about utility than beauty. And that's fine because I'm just going to mark it up anyway with my highlighting.
Picture, it's fine. You find some meme or something and that makes everybody laugh. But I'm not in the meme business. That's some professional comedians can do that. I'm just a guy with a blog. So you got to know what you're good at.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. One thing I found with the Texas Supreme Court was, you know, there are others out there who are already doing the same kind of work, like Osler. You know, you get Osler summaries in the email every week, and of course now that's been taken over. And it's like, well, why am I going to sit down and summarize the Texas Supreme Court cases when you've got the staff attorney already doing that?
That's right. And the Supreme Court, you know, they've worked their tail off in the last couple of years with all the COVID orders and all these election cases and all that. That's fantastic. And there's a lot of output. How much is relevant to what I do? Not a whole lot. A lot of those statutory interpretation questions, very important for Texas, very important for certain industry groups, but just not that relevant to a general civil trial practice. So I was finding that, you know, the email that you talk about, Todd, would come out. There'd be all these summaries and I was glad to read it, but there wasn't a whole lot that I wanted to really engage beyond that. So, you know, the occasional case will come along and I'll just handle it somewhere else. It's just a different rhythm. And other people are covering it and covering it very well. And, you know, gobble, there's plenty of courts to go around.
Absolutely. Every appellate lawyer in Texas could have their local appellate lawyer.
Yes. So, like I say, the United States of America has 13 intermediate courts of appeals and one Supreme Court. We, of course, in Texas have 14 and two Supreme Courts because we are off, right? So
not to be outdone.
Everything's bigger.
That's right.
Another thing that you're known for, particularly in the DFW area, is a kind of a frequent appearance in the media as a legal commentator. How did you get into that?
So Michael Hurst joined our firm, I think, in 2015. He brought with him a relationship with a well-known communications firm. They do a lot of different things called Andrevet Consulting here in town. And he, being a new partner and trying to get along with his new partner, said, anybody who wants to meet my friends from Andrevet can schedule a conference. They'll be here next week. So being a blogger at the time, I scheduled it, thought that would be interesting. We meet. They say, what is your law practice? What do you do? I said, civil appellate law. And that was like a conversation killer. And it was like a ton of ice fell out of the ceiling into the middle of the room. And so everyone's kind of smiling awkwardly at each other for the next few minutes. But to the credit of Barry Pound, who's a partner at that firm, he said, is that kind of like constitutional law? I said, well, yeah. I mean, it's not every day, but I handle constitutional issues in my practice. And constitutional issues are the bread of what we have courts of appeals for, is to resolve that kind of question. So I'm not going to tell you I'm the world's biggest expert, but sure, that's part of what I do. Conversation ends, months go by. I figure I'm never going to hear from those people again. And I don't, until there's an election in 2016. Surprisingly to most people, Donald Trump wins the popular vote. Some time goes by and Andrevet gets a call, which they then relay to me, from a reporter in town wondering if anyone knows about faithless electors, Hamilton electors. I said, no, I don't know a darn thing about them, but notice neither does anybody else in Dallas. If you want somebody local, which I gather that you do, I mean, I'm as good as anybody else. I can go read about it and come up with some things. And if you really want to scratch and find some law professor in Washington, you can, but that's going to take you a few days. So having boldly proclaimed that, I got the line. And those guys move fast. I mean, in the morning when they decide to have a story at 9, they're there. That was back when they sent camera crews around. Now it's all by Zoom. At 10:30, they're knocking at the door with the camera. So I said, I'm ready to go, acting like I knew what I was doing. Where do I sit? where do I look? And they sat me down, showed me where to look, and we got along great. He was a Sean Rabb was a reporter, very conversational guy. He's interviewed tons of people, have never done it before, you know, help me understand what he was looking for. It went wonderfully. And then Trump is inaugurated, and it's one constitutional thing after another for the next 4 years. I mean, when I spoke to those Andrevet people, the idea of a constitutional law commentator was just, there wasn't one.
Sure.
Maybe nationally CNN would have somebody talk about a Supreme Court case or something, but the Trump administration, everybody's a constitutional lawyer all of a sudden. And that created the demand. And so I started getting a whole bunch of calls about that, kind of understood how it worked and got some basic familiarity with how the media process works. And that sort of created the position. Now the producers think of constitutional angles to things they might not otherwise think of. And there's more demand than there was before. So I basically owe it to Donald Trump, who greatly stimulated interest in our country about the Constitution during his time in office. Nothing like a couple of impeachments to, you know, get people going. And I like to think that constitutional law is one of the things that the glory of the internet has made everyone an expert on over the last few. Infectious disease is one of those areas. Everybody is an expert on infectious disease. Constitutional law and lately armored battle strategy is something everyone's an expert on, like how to blow up. Everybody and their dog knows about that. So I'm in step with what the internet university has been handing out PhDs in these last few years.
Yeah, that's consistent with what I've seen on my social media feeds the last few years.
Alternate. So. The same people that are really good at constitutional law will just quit that, and then they pick up their infectious disease thing for a while.
Just wearing a lot of hats. Yeah.
But now they're all, they know all about tanks and missiles and stuff. So,
Well, one of the things I appreciate about you, David, is you don't take yourself too seriously.
Well, that's the thing. I share this stuff on social media because I am, you know, I'm doing it so that so people can see my smiling face. But if I post, I'm this amazing guy and here's this awesome thing I did, people are going to switch me off. And they got off switches. Mm-hmm. So you have to come at it playfully. Yeah.
You're just as likely to be poking fun at yourself, though. And, you know, when I see you posted on Facebook and it's David Cole, constitutional law expert. Usually there's some kind of self-deprecating comment about, you know, this is not an area in which I appear to be an expert exactly, but I'm going to talk about it anyway.
So there are occasions when I've said things that I'm pleased with myself for having said something profound, and then that actually got on the air. The one that really set the record for, was, remember a couple of years ago, Ezekiel Elliott was in all this legal trouble and the NFL was going to suspend him and the Cowboy, he sued to be reinstated. And there was a lawsuit in Eastern District in Judge Mazant's court. And there was a parallel lawsuit in New York at the NFL brought. So there's all these lawsuits. And the first week or so of that, the pundit world was dominated by these quote unquote sports lawyers talking about all that. Who are these people? I have no idea who these people are, but these sports lawyers are saying all this stuff, some of it accurate, about these legal proceedings. And I thought, they're going to get tired of these sports lawyers after a while. And sure enough, after about a week of that, the sports people found their way to my door. And so these sports reporters are showing up in the office with their cameras. I was explaining to them, so appellate law, it's like a booth review, right? They take the tape and they watch it again. And they're like, oh, yeah, we get that. Yeah. So they were really likable. They really wanted to do a good story and do it right. And so this one particular thing, it looked like Judge Mazant's latest ruling might go to the Fifth Circuit and then even be possibly considered for en banc review. This is the quote that got on the air from about a 10-minute discussion about this as follows. When the two new members of the court are confirmed, the court will go from 13 to 15 members.
Right there. The hard-hitting right journalism
there.
On the air.
There it was. I added 13 and 2.
David Cole, math expert.
Right there.
Yeah, that's right.
Right there on the air. And then right after that, they were trying to fill a little airtime because this judge in New York was supposed to rule a certain time and he hadn't ruled. So they popped that up there. And then what are they going to do next? I think, here's what they did next. They had some Dallas Cowboy in the locker room and they stuck a mic in his face and said, what do you think about the Ezekiel Elliott arbitration? This guy has no earthly idea, right? So he's like, well, we're just trying to win the football game. Get out there and score. Like a minute of just random thoughts about football.
And we really try to score more points than the other team.
Yeah, right. I'm like, you guys are not going to win the Emmy for this one. This is not going the right way. I'm adding to 15. This guy is talking about whatever. But that was kind of an unusual thing. Generally speaking, these guys work their tails off. They start in the morning. They have a meeting, mm-hmm. decide what they're going to cover. They hustle around, get their footage. And I mean, 5 o'clock, it's like our deadlines. When the judge says, you know, Mr. Smith, you may proceed. You better proceed. 5 o'clock, the little thing is going to run, and they're on the air, and they either it's done.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not a question about it being done. It's just whether you have it all in the pieces there or not. I admire that. You hustle every day. It's a stressful job.
I bet it is. Yeah. You can't get extensions quite like you can in the law. Yeah, sometimes.
No, 5 o'clock. Can we do the 5 o'clock news at 6 o'clock today? Uh-uh. No. 5 o'clock. And, you know, it's, there are some things where you're familiar with it. You've covered it before, and they try to develop expertise. They'll have one person that covers the courthouse or city hall or what have you, and they know people. But, you know, you're going to get stuff someday as a reporter, and you're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
One time one of these reporters was leaving me. It was a question that had something to do with the military, and there was a veteran they were going to interview about the issue. And he was at some truck stop over in Irving, and he was on the phone with this guy at this truck stop saying, okay, we'll be there in 15 minutes. And I thought, whew, boy, what a day. I mean, from the lawyer, law office to the truck stop. So that's just how they do it.
You think you've seen like a, I mean, obviously your face is on the news and your name.
God bless, God save the news.
I mean, people would look at that and say, well, I wonder how that affects in business development, say mm-hmm. from outside cases. I mean, you've got plenty of work coming in, sounds like through your own law firm, through the firm and supporting the trial lawyers there. But what effect has that had on your business development within your law firm?
Yeah. So the media is a lot like sort of winning various lawyer recognitions that you can win. It raises your reputation. It gives you more cachet if you're in the discussion for a particular representation, but it doesn't lead to work by itself. Some general counsel is presented with a choice among various appellate lawyers, and they say, oh, yeah, David, I saw him on TV last week. You have a leg up there. So if you're already in the conversation, it certainly is a plus because it just gives you, I mean, you're familiar, you're a known quantity, but no one's going to call you because they saw you on TV. That said, I do receive occasional voicemail, email messages from people that saw me on TV and want me to take their case. I have yet to accept one. So the sort of contact you make with the community through the media is probably not what's going to lead to a lot of business, but it definitely contributes in the same way that winning recognition as a super lawyer or something contributes to your stature, but it's an indirect way of assisting with business development. It's not a direct way.
Right up there with blogging or maybe bar service.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. It's a thing. It's good to do. But like, I wouldn't do it if I didn't enjoy it. If I didn't have fun doing it, if I didn't think like it was useful to help. I mean, it was a good thing to help explain to those sports guys how the appellate process worked. That was time well spent. They learned. I learned. Everybody was better for that. What got on the air? It's another matter. It's useful to try to educate people about what we do and how our courts work. We need more of that in our society today. So that makes me feel good. I enjoy doing that. But if it was a drag, I'd have quit doing it a long time ago. If it was just a source of stress, no way. You have stuff like that. Like you just said, Todd, you know all about that from your various social media things you've had over time. It's just not, if you don't like it, it's never going to work. You've got to do stuff you enjoy.
That's right.
100%.
You know, and I just happen to like reading Intermediate Court of Appeals opinions, writing a blog about them. And there aren't that many people that like to do that, but that's just their loss and my gain. I just like it.
Well, you're among friends on this podcast, then. We all like reading Intermediate Court of Appeals.
Years ago, I haven't done this in a while. I was going to restart it this year, but I would send out a communication or mailing or whatever. It said top 5 cases from the XYZ court for the previous quarter, half year or something. And one time I got an email from somebody who was like, wow, those are the top 5 cases from the Fifth Circuit, then it must not have been very busy, and sort of gigging my choice of the top 5 cases. I'm like, make your own list. You don't like my list. I don't care what you think about my list. It's my list.
That's right. These are Cole's top 5 cases.
Make your own list. Oh, what's that? You didn't read any of all the cases. So you're not really in a position to criticize my list, are you?
But there are always going to be critics.
You know, you don't like my top 5? You know, I'm sorry for that. My life's going to go right on pretty much unchanged with that knowledge.
What are some things that attorneys might keep in mind if they're dealing with the media, whether on their own case or just in general, kind of giving commentary? Any tips or thoughts?
I have several. Let me just jump to technical stuff first and then think back to strategy a little bit. Reporters are, they are professional BS detectors. They know when they're being lied to or when you're fudging. Even if they don't know the subject matter well, they're like, they know. So you have to be speaking in a straightforward, honest way with them, or they'll just totally switch off. They genuinely want to get it right. I mean, if they get a reputation as a sloppy reporter, that doesn't help them. If they get a reporter as someone who's accurate and honest, that only helps their stature. And so a lot of the time, if you talk to a reporter about something, 95% of the conversation is you helping them understand what they're working on. And in exchange for that, they'll put a little soundbite on there, you know, as kind of payment for your services in a way. That's a very crass way of saying it. But look, you gave me your time generously to help me do my story. I'll give you a little bit of my time to show my thanks for that. And so you have to come at it, and this is true to reporters and to the audiences they're ultimately trying to reach. You have to not overload your conversation with jargon. You can't just throw out a bunch of acronyms and numbers and things and expect people to understand. You can't over outline things. You have to just sort of speak in one level of bullet points. The flip of that, and it ties to what I was saying about being honest, you cannot ever talk down to a media audience or a reporter and say, you know, the Constitution, that's that document we signed to form our country. That's just, right. You just turned everybody off. And we have a tendency sometimes to do that as lawyers, and we're dealing with non-lawyers, is to inadvertently come across as patronizing. And you have to be very mindful of that, just as much as you have to be mindful of overdoing it and throwing in too much technical stuff. So that's just sort of the, what audience are you speaking to? You're speaking to an intelligent person who probably doesn't know all the vocabulary, wants to be able to develop their story and share it with an audience that's similarly generally interested, but doesn't know a lot of vocabulary, doesn't have a lot of time, and really doesn't want to be BS'd around. Now, back to strategy, it depends on why you're talking to the media. If you're talking to them because they need help with a story, you proceed, like I said, they want to be educated, you educate them, you speak until the conversation's done. You don't hurry, you just answer questions they have, you help them understand, you teach. If you're talking about a case or something, you have to be a little more judicious there. My experience is reporters, we have a fear in our business of the press. We're worried the press is going to get to talk to us and they're going to say something and we're going to feel bad about that. If you're dealing with a reporter and you want to say something to them, but you don't want it to appear on the front page of the paper, you have to say to them, I'd like to talk to you on background about this. And then they have to say back to you, yes, we're talking on background. That's sort of the journalistic ethical standard. I can't quote you chapter and verse on that, but that's the way it's supposed to work, textbook. If you both say that, they're going to honor that. A reputable journalist will not use your name in connection with what you have to say. So that's just something to know. Even then, some clients are often have their own views about the press and want you not talking even on background or whatever. And that's fine. You have to respect that as representing the client. But that's if you have a case and the press is covering it and you want to influence that and the client is okay with you doing that, you can befriend the reporter and talk to them and explain to them, here's why we did what we did this day. Here's what this exhibit is. Here's what's coming up. All with the understanding that it's on background. It's just like the reporter that you're educating for their segment on the news. You're teaching them, and they're going to respond to that probably in a positive way. That doesn't mean they're going to write a great story about your client, but at least they're not going to torch him. And at least they won't write out of ignorance. They may learn everything you said and decide that your case still sucks, but at least you had your chance. You know, at least you got them talking about something relevant instead of just, you know, the fact that your client didn't look good on the stand that day. So there are people out there that are hostile and have agendas and axes to grind, but the people that cover cases and do legal work, they generally do it all the time. They don't want to get a reputation as someone who's dishonest or a jerk or unfair, and they want to learn. So if you approach them that way, are very careful about what's for on the record and not on the record, you can do a lot by way of educating people about your case or a legal position or what have you without endangering, you know, what you want to be doing in court. Now, judges sometimes clamp down that too and say, nobody's going to talk to the press, in which case you should not talk to the press. Sure. Courts have that inherent authority. Yeah. And even the most carefully maintained background, it will be obvious to the court that somebody associated with the case was the speaker and then everybody gets in trouble. So you don't want to do that. But, you know, subject, of course, to that kind of ground rule from the court or from the client, you know, you can treat the press with respect and they'll treat you back with respect, even if they don't always go the way you want them to go.
What you were saying about sort of educating the reporter, you know, I could see parallels between that and your everyday job as an appellate lawyer trying to educate the courts. It just, that role seems very similar.
There's a lot of overlap there. I mean, you're obviously not educating the judge about the standard of review or anything like that. But flip, same side, by not talking about that kind of thing, you're showing the respect and not patronizing. You come into an experienced appellate panel and you say, well, judge, as you know, we're here on a de novo standard of review. They're going to be like, who invited you? Why are you here? You're wasting their time on stuff they already know. Right. But they probably don't know X, Y, or Z. Like, why exactly is your client in this business? What do they do? How does that work? And what the heck happened with it? They genuinely want to know. They're not. But so you got to explain it in a way where they can, you either answer all their question or you get them going in the right way to where they can get in the briefs and understand it with the benefit of your explanation. Absolutely. They're definite parallels, not the same subject matter, but the same concept applies quite a bit. And with clients too, they have a question about the legal system. You know, when am I going to hear from the court?
Well, who knows? Great question.
But you can, but aside of just kind of the, oh my goodness, who knows? You can explain, look, there's, this is going on, that's going on, I've got all this stuff. And there's just a lot to do down there. And we're in line. It's very important to us, but there's 500 other people who it's also very important to. And that, you know, that kind of explanation about the system can come in handy.
That sort of general commentary, informative commentary, I think is a very useful service that you provide in interfacing with the media. You know, the other thing we hear about in terms of lawyers and media is trial lawyers sort of trying their case in the media.
Right. Yep.
And there's a big cautionary tale to be told on that, because our Supreme Court has said that the cloak of judicial privilege does not necessarily extend that far. So, you know, what you're talking about, what you do day in, day out, you're not standing in front of the media talking about your own cases and trying to taint the jury pool.
I would not do that unless I had a very clear mission to do that for some client or another. And I don't know who that client would be. Mm-hmm. But you're like, we saw this with the, I think some of these statements by courts you're talking about, Todd, are in the context of this litigation about the 2020 mm-hmm. election, most of which didn't go very well for the people challenging it. I mean, those lawyers were in the media a lot. Mm-hmm. And they were not just talking about what's in the pleadings. That was carefully drafted. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I got a lot of litigation as a result of that. Unusual situation, but, you know, definitely cautionary tales there.
Yep.
Let's kind of switch over to your podcast, because I don't want to leave that out. Tell us a little bit about it, kind of, you know, how it got started and what it is.
So suggested to me by, again, Sean Rabb from Fox 4, the first guy I've met in this business who did the interview about the Hamilton electors. We got to know each other because we did several other things as the Trump administration continued there. And he said, you ought to do a podcast. The kind of thing we do, because a typical sit down Zoom type of interview with a reporter, 10, 15 minutes, you can do that on just about any of these topics. You know, kind of the questions and answers that people are interested in. So you could easily do that. And he even suggested the name. And so I kind of nodded politely, and then the pandemic came and everybody's sitting at home and I said, well, maybe I'll start that podcast. Read about sort of the technical stuff you need, like a decent microphone, that kind of thing, and started out. And the Androvet folks helped teach me that you need a little music at the beginning and that kind of thing. And I got to where I could do all that. And whenever the mood strikes me and I record, I feel I have a thought, I will record David talking for about 15 minutes. I do interviews as well. I started doing that once the pandemic sort of wound down and people were out and about again. Those are much better liked than David talking. And I've found all sorts of people, I mean, college friends and lots of non-lawyers. And you can edit it down to about half an hour and you can talk about something of general interest to the legal community and people will like that. So it's sort of the whole blogging thing started because I was reading the cases anyway. And then it's relatively easy to leverage that into discussion about the cases, which includes the media. Mm-hmm. And once you're doing that, it's relatively easy to leverage that into sort of leading your own discussions, which is what podcasting is. But there again, it's a very specific model. I don't do hour-long episodes. I could never do that. If I tried to do that, I'd run into the sin of blogging, which is trying to be brilliant every week or two. It's better to just put something out every couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Although with podcasting, I will take much longer breaks than with blogging. With blogging, I really don't like to let more than a week or two go by without having something, because people just forget you're there. Podcasting, it doesn't really matter. If you let it go for some time, you can return to it pretty easily, mm-hmm. and they'll still come back to you. So I'm more comfortable taking a break from that if I feel the need to. And it does take a little more time just because it's longer. But once I kind of learned how reporters did what they do, I sort of started doing it myself on a much smaller scale, is the quick answer to how I got into it and what guides me. It's just things that I think people will find interesting, or that I want to talk about, or just friends of mine who I think have interesting perspectives on the world.
That makes sense.
Like you guys, in a week or two, I'll ask you.
You're not limiting yourself to legal topics then?
They generally have something to do with the law, although I interviewed recently the interior architect that we worked with at my original law firm when we moved space, who I've kept up with over the years. And I've interviewed her about what are law firms doing as they return to the downtown office buildings? Are they revamping their space, or do they have new needs? And we talked for half an hour about that. It was really interesting. She had a lot of different perspectives about that. So that's not really legal, but mm-hmm. It is. It's about the practice of law and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's legal loosely.
I don't know. There's something to that, though. I mean, particularly with your sort of role to explain things to the public in a way that makes sense to them. I think that there's a lot of value there doing it that way, and kind of making it not strictly high level legal discussions for people that maybe want to pick up some learning.
My most successful episode so far in terms of people looking is an interview with a guy I knew in college who's a communications professor at a college in Georgia. We did a thing on critical race theory. What is it? And does mm-hmm. our Texas statute about it in fact deal with it? And a very engaging guy, talked 100 miles an hour. It took forever to edit that episode. His southern accents, like Millie Mile. Geez, slow down. But he's really good. He's very well spoken. And I would read him excerpts from the statute and say, is that describing critical race study as you understand it? He would say, nope. And he would explain what he understood mm-hmm. the statute to be about. It was well-liked, and I frequently send the link to people when these CRT things pop mm-hmm. up and discussions about school boards. So you got to listen to this guy just to get a little perspective. I'm not saying he has all the answers, but he can teach you a little bit more than you're going to learn tweeting about it.
No, that's interesting.
Well, one of the nice things about hosting your own podcast is you kind of get to pick the conversation.
Yes. And mm-hmm. it's kind of like my top five list. If you don't want my guest, don't listen.
That's right.
Right. And, you know, we try to sort of debunk the notion that all we ever talk about is media pellet issues, because, mm-hmm. I mean, who would actually listen to that? So totally, I get it, you know, going beyond just legal stuff, and we go beyond the pellet stuff all the time. Yeah. And
people enjoy the dialogue. If you look at news stories, you know, a lot of the time they'll have an interview or two, you know, very short, just to break it up. And if it's just some reporter sitting there talking the whole time, who wants to watch that? But if you have, you know, something that gets you moving out of the studio, look, another person with books and stuff behind them, it's just more engaging. It just makes the story go better.
I bet your experience is similar to ours too, in that, you know, we do this because we enjoy doing it, mm-hmm. but as much as anything, you know, we learn from our visits with our guests. And so, I mean, just today, having heard you talk about, I've seen you post on social media about your interviews and all that. And I think it's amusing when you make fun of yourself doing that. But you've given me today a whole new perspective on, well, you know, what are the things to think about as you're getting into dealing with a media call? And, you know, the whole idea of being on background, I think, is a really significant thing to know. And you've given me information today that I didn't have before.
There you go.
It was worth the price of admission, right?
Well, there you go. And it's worth, look, some reporter is going to call you someday, maybe tomorrow even, and say, Todd, what's going on with this? You can say, look, I can't talk to you. Todd Smith can't talk to you about that, but let's just go behind the curtain for a second. And they'll appreciate that. They'll, okay, I get it. I can do my story better now. You know, like questions like, what exactly does this court do? Or they filed a writ of what? And mm-hmm. you know, let me just talk to you about that and why they're doing these things. And that's that's invaluable to somebody that just, they have no reason to know that. Mm-hmm. No more reason to know that than how the plumbing works. It's just not something to deal with every day.
So. Sure. Absolutely.
You bet.
I haven't had a plumber yet. Maybe I can find a good
There's got to be a legal angle to that, I'm sure.
We had a plumbing break out here in the hall. This building is a very nice building, but it was built in the early 80s. And we do have the occasional issue about an older building. And we had a water. So unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of water in it. We had this leak out in the hall for half an hour until we realized, well, that dripping noise is coming from the roof.
Jeez.
Yeah, awkward. Yeah. But
I was going to say, you have a built-in podcast guest right there.
That's right.
Yeah. Go grab the guy and say, hey.
I would have interviewed him, but I was more interested in getting the leak fixed.
That's fair. Get the water back on and running again.
Focus on the substance here, not the procedure. So anyway, now you know the story. And it's all, it keeps you interested. If you don't like it, you shouldn't be doing it. If you like it and you're enjoying it, it makes everything, the rising tide lifts all boats. It makes the practice a lot more fun.
Absolutely.
You do a fun thing, you go talk to a reporter and you come back and you're excited to work on your cases and you do a better job on them. And it's everything is energized by doing it. At least that's my experience. Mm-hmm. So go forth and blog.
Well, that makes total sense.
Only if you like it. Don't do it because you think that some other reason, like it'll look good on my resume or something. Don't do that.
Right.
You're just going to cause yourself stress and you're not going to be happy with the product.
Be authentic. Absolutely.
Life's too short not to be.
There you go.
You have to enjoy what you're doing, regardless of what it is.
For sure.
It's absolutely true.
I have to ask you about one other media appearance, though, that you mentioned on your website bio, which is that you have been fictionalized as an attorney in a romance novel. I have to hear more about that.
So my wife, we're both very lucky to have law practices that we really like. I really enjoy my practice. And she, for a number of years, did bankruptcy work. She was a Weil Gotshal doing bankruptcy work during the Enron bankruptcy and moved to a smaller firm, was doing that. And she's always, ever since she's been able to read, she's been a big romance novel fan. She really likes romance novels, just something she really enjoys reading. And she just happened to get a client who was a romance writer who was having a problem with, to make a long story short, a publisher that was in some financial straits, needed bankruptcy counsel to help work the situation out. She did. And from there has developed a full-time practice as lawyer to the romance novelist. She's a solo practitioner. She practices in our house and she represents romance writers. She's picked up a few other kinds of writers. So she goes to romance writer conventions. She talks to romance writers on the phone. She reads advanced copies of romance novels. She knows what's going on in the romance scene. And one of her clients, Joanna Wild, has a series called the Reaper series about a motorcycle gang. And I got to know Joanna some. She would come to town for things, we'd meet. And so she wrote in a character into her last Reaper book, Dobie Coles. And I have an excerpt from it I put up on the wall here. It says, Dobie Coles had been one of the Reaper's attorneys for nearly 10 years now. He looked like a big, dumb, good old boy, which had served us well many times. But the man was effing brilliant. Couldn't imagine anyone I'd rather have on my side. It was Sunday afternoon and Coles sat across me across a table holding a file folder of papers I sincerely hoped included a strategy to save my ass. Coles was good, very good. So I have that blown up on my wall here with a cover. And the cover is this guy, you know, real buff guy with a leather thing. And so Reaper's Fire. Yeah,
that's a very nice
good one. I reckon there's another Reaper's book that she has finished, but hasn't made his way to publication yet. I don't know if Dobie Coles is in that one or not, but
maybe he'll get his own series.
That's right.
You know, how could you not with a description like that? The big, dumb, good old boy. I was like, you put me in as a big, dumb, good old boy. Thanks. But, yeah, Dobie Coles, my alter ego there in the Reaper's gang. I think he could get the guy, the Reaper, out of jail. I actually confess I haven't read much past that day, so I don't really know. But if you think we have wild stuff in our practice sometimes, ooh, romance writers.
It's a wild bunch.
Well, David, we sure appreciate you being with us. You know, our tradition here is to invite our guests to offer a tip or a war story to share with our audience. Do you have something that's come to mind that you'd like to share?
I'll just tell a funny war story. It has really no relevance to anything. But Jody, because you're on the line, and I promised you I'd tell you the David Keltner Zoom story. I thought I would tell you that. And so we're all on Zoom here on this call. I had a Zoom argument several months ago. It was a Fort Worth case that got transferred to Amarillo under the docket control thing. And Keltner was on the other side. And we we're getting ready to go online. We're in the room waiting for the click, and it goes over to YouTube. And I make a joke of something like, well, Mr. Keltner, you're looking very hip there, all this high-tech stuff. And he kind of perks up there and says, you may know the guy that's at issue. He says, it's, you know, that does his glasses there and says, it's not me, David. I'm blessed to have on my team Joe, whatever his name is. Joe is, I have done 100 Zoom hearings and he knows everything. He is a master of Zoom. And we've done Zooms here and there and everywhere. And they have been amazing, all because of Joe. And I, like any experienced litigator, I'm thinking, you are jinxing Joe. Stop it. Stop. Don't do it. And so he talks up Joe some more and we go online. He's the appellant. You know, ladies and gentlemen, may it please the court, rah, 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 rah. He goes for about a little over a minute and Kelly Hart and Hallman loses its internet connection. The whole firm goes black. Like they're like trying to email it. It won't work. And so we're all just kind of sitting there. So we go offline and a few minutes goes by and they, you know, whoever it is in your basement, your building there that rides the bike to turn the lights, they get it back on again. Joe is nowhere to be seen.
That was not my day to do that.
Went out the window, but they're back on. Everybody's kind of razzing Keltner. And this one judge from the Amarillo court leans in and goes, Mr. Keltner, says, when we go back online, you ought to look at the camera and tell everybody you're not a cat. Perfect.
Perfect. Absolutely.
Absolutely perfect. Totally captured the moment. The whole Zoom thing there. Just died laughing. Keltner won the case, by the way. Darn him. So I'm, I have a petition for review on file. But that was really funny. And of course, you know, David's larger than life and has a good sense of humor. So
yeah, he does.
Good thing. I don't know. If, Joe is not the guy's name. You probably know what I'm talking about.
I don't know. I'll have to ask around and find out, though.
Yeah, well, he got totally jinxed. He was like,
of course, you're absolutely right.
No.
quit saying it.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Just asking the litigation gods to smack you down. The old smacko right there. So that's my war story. It's not really relevant to anything except it's just Zoom causes funny stuff to happen, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't have to be relevant, and it was entertaining.
No, it's just, you know, we've all had stuff like that, and the whole cat thing was just, you know, priceless, so... That's great.
David, thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely.
It was a delight to talk to you guys, and I'll look forward to talking to you in a week.
Sounds good.
Y'all take care. Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.